The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your weekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined this week by Clark Neely and Evan Burnick of IJ's Center for Judicial Engagement. Before we begin, a quick programming note. We're going to dial down the podcast to once every 2 weeks. As always, comments and suggestions are welcome. Send them to shortcircuit@ij.org. This week on the show, illegal bank deposits, a parolee's prison escape, handcuffing a quadriplegic, and a police shooting. Clark, kick us off.
Well, the first case comes to us out of the Second Circuit, and it involves our old friend structuring, which, for those who don't remember, is a federal crime where you are engaging in cash transactions with a bank, and you break up or structure those transactions so that the amount of the deposit or the withdrawal is always under $10,000. $10,000, of course, is the magic number for when the bank has to file a CTR or a currency transaction report with the Treasury to flag people who are working with large amounts of cash. The point of that, of course, is to try to enable the government to track money, discourage counterfeiting, money laundering, funding terrorists, and so forth. The problem is that lots of people engage in legitimate cash transactions and legitimate cash businesses. The defendant in this case doesn't happen to be one of them. He's actually a drug dealer. And so they get him convicted on the drug distribution charge, but they also stack up some structuring charges because of the way he deposited the cash that he got from the drug sales. And the question is whether the conviction, he did go to a jury trial in this case, he was convicted on the drug charges and the structuring charges, and the question in this case is whether the conviction on the structuring charges stands up.
Evan, what was the basis for the structuring charge?
The basis for the structuring charge, this guy is a co-owner of the liquor, of a liquor store, and he takes the money that he makes in as a consequence of his drug dealing. He puts it into the liquor store's account, and then he channels that into a bank account. And the charge is that he structured his deposits in that bank account to avoid federal reporting requirements, which would have raised red flags about where what the source of his income is.
Now, the problem here is that structuring actually has three elements, and it's not enough that you simply break up deposits, cash transactions with a bank. The third element actually requires that you do so for the purpose of causing the currency reporting report not to be filed. And that's the element on which the government's proof was lacking in this case. If you simply look at a snapshot, a very selective snapshot of some of the transactions, it does look like there was a pattern of doing under $10,000 deposits. But if you look at all of the evidence in its totality, which is what you have to do or what you're supposed to do, and in fact what the Second Circuit does, what you would see is that this guy was routinely going into the bank on other occasions and depositing more than $10,000 in cash. And as he points out in his appellate brief, it would be a pretty ridiculous scheme of structuring to only sometimes break up your deposits to remain under $10,000, but then often to deposit more than $10,000. That absolutely is not going to work in terms of trying to keep you under the radar or prevent the government from tracking your cash transactions. So there was a failure of proof on the third element, namely the mens rea, the requirement that you prove that the defendant engaged in the conduct for the purpose of preventing reports from being filed. The government had no proof on that point, and so the structuring convictions were reversed.
Yeah, on top of everything that Clark has just said, this bank apparently had a practice of not only informing customers that if you deposit over $10,000, that triggers reporting requirements, but we also report to the IRS if you make two deposits which collectively go over $10,000. And there was no evidence that this guy wasn't aware of this. In order to make out a structuring charge, you need to show that not only did this person deliberately know about federal reporting requirements, but they also had to know that the bank in question, in which you're depositing money, was going to make that report. And there's no evidence that this the teller that he was interacting with, he kept dealing with the same teller, did not tell him about the policy of reporting to the IRS, both over $10,000 and under $10,000, in the aggregate over $10,000.
Clark, IJ also works on structuring cases. Does this case shed any light on our litigation?
Oh, absolutely. So one of the things that we've seen over and over and over again is that the government will initiate a forfeiture, and you initiate it by seizing the money. So they will seize money in connection with a forfeiture investigation on probable cause, which these days is really nothing more than a hunch. when it's quite clear that the government is not going to be able to meet all of the elements of the structuring violation, then if they did try to take the case, for example, the criminal route, and try to secure a conviction, there's no way they could do it because they just don't have any evidence of at least one of the elements. And often the missing element is the intent to avoid the reporting requirement. So the point here is that it is much, much easier for the government to seize your cash on an alleged structuring violation than it is for the government to actually prove in open court that a structuring violation occurred. And that's why the government absolutely prefers to go the civil forfeiture route as opposed to the criminal forfeiture route. Why? Because there's no way in most of these cases the government would be able to secure a criminal conviction. And what they really want to be able to do is grab your cash and hold on to it with the absolute bare minimum of proof. And it's not even proof. It's just probable cause necessary. And then, of course, because it's civil forfeiture, all of the burdens shift to the property owner to try to get the property back. It's just a much easier way to take people's money.
Evan, let's move on to the next case.
So this case involves a man who's sentenced to 25 years to life in prison in a New York jail. During the early part of his prison sentence, 7 years in, he escapes and he's on the loose for about 3 years, at which point he's reapprehended, sent back to jail. And for the rest of his 21 years in prison, he's actually an exemplary model inmate, behaves very well. And as a consequence of this good behavior, he's granted parole. The parole board is presumably aware of his escape. It's prominent in all of his documents, although it's not explicitly mentioned. But
Not explicitly mentioned by the parole board when deciding to grant his release.
Right.
It is explicitly mentioned throughout the documents.
It is explicitly mentioned throughout the documents, but not by the parole board itself. Anyway, he's granted parole, and over the course of time, it comes to the attention of members of the parole board that Governor Pataki, who's the governor of New York—
At that time, in around 1999.
Around 1999. Is very much adverse to the idea of granting parole to people who have committed crimes of violence. And the guy is called back, and his parole is actually rescinded. And cited as the reason for why his parole is rescinded, the officials point to the fact of his escape, claiming that they were unaware of the fact that he had escaped during his initial parole hearing. And the question is whether they actually— whether that was actually truthful or whether that was just a pretext to rescind this guy's parole because the governor was upset by it.
Look, let's just be frank. This is a disgraceful and horrifying case. It is abundantly clear from between the lines in the Second Circuit opinion that two things occurred in this case. First, that one of the members of the parole commission that subsequently decided to revoke the parole was, in fact, the only witness, so to speak, to provide testimony that the original panel was unaware of the previous escape. So in other words, you have somebody who's participating in what amounts to the adjudication of the decision whether to grant parole, who is also a percipient witness, the only witness supplying the supposed information that the earlier panel was unaware of the earlier escape. And it is abundantly clear that besides being both a judge and a witness in the same case, that this individual is in fact lying about whether the earlier panel was aware or unaware of the earlier escape. So you have a partial adjudicator, because that person is also a witness effectively in the same case, and that same person is almost certainly fabricating evidence in order to keep this person in jail. And the question, mind-bogglingly enough, is whether that raises any serious constitutional concerns regarding the ultimate decision to refuse or to rescind the decision to grant this individual parole. It is an astonishing case. And let's be also give credit where it's due. The Second Circuit gets it right, sends it back to the district court to give this prisoner an opportunity to have those claims adjudicated.
Right. The Second Circuit recognizes that this guy had a right to be released as a consequence of the original adjudication. He was granted parole, and to the extent that he's now going to be kept in jail, that affects a liberty of, a vital liberty interest that he has. The district court below actually held that the commissioner, who Clark just described, was absolutely immune for constitutional violations because he was acting as an adjudicator. Judges or adjudicators have absolute immunity from constitutional courts while they're judging. But as the Second Circuit pointed out, what the prisoner was actually alleging is that a series of events, a conspiracy was developed among various New York officials to do precisely what was done in that adjudication. So even if he had immunity as a in his role as an adjudicator, that doesn't cover all of the activities leading up to what he did, including his conspiracy, alleged conspiracy, to rescind this guy's parole on the basis of fabricated evidence.
Yeah, not to put too fine a point on it, but there is a difference between fabricating evidence and adjudicating cases. And when you are engaged in the fabrication of evidence, you are not entitled to immunity that attaches to adjudicators. That seems like a simple proposition. It is one that, gratifyingly, the Second Circuit got right in this case.
Okay, let's move on to the next case. Clark.
The next case is also a horrifying and dismaying case. It involves a prisoner in the Cook County Department of Corrections who was a quadriplegic. He was rendered a quadriplegic after he got in a car accident during which he was driving under the influence of drugs. The passenger was killed. He was rendered a quadriplegic. And the police took him into custody about a year later so that he could be tried for those crimes or for that crime. Apparently the Cook County Sheriff's Office, who was in charge of keeping him in custody, had a policy of always shackling pretrial prisoners who are hospitalized by one hand and one foot, no matter what. That's the policy. The problem for this guy is that because he is a quadriplegic, that prevents him from moving around in his hospital bed, which he has to do in order to avoid bed sores, and they leave him shackled by hand and by foot for a full month in the hospital while he complains about the problems that this causes him in terms of his need to move around to avoid bed sores, and nobody does anything. Why? Because they have a policy. And later on, he seeks to challenge this mistreatment, this grievous mistreatment, and his case is thrown out by the district court. Well, there's another claim, too. So that's the first thing. The other thing that happens is that when he actually ends up out of the hospital and in jail, he has a special chair, and he needs assistance moving back and forth from his chair to his bed. And if he doesn't get that assistance again, he's going to have problem with sores. And he doesn't get that help. And he tries to challenge the failure to provide that help as well. And the district court throws out both of those claims on the premise that he failed to exhaust his administrative remedies, which prisoners are required to do before they can have access to federal court when they charge that they've been mistreated, as this man manifestly was.
Right. So according to the administrative policy they have in place, an inmate has to file a written grievance within 15 days of the alleged incident. The problem, at least for his first claim, is that he wasn't even aware of the policy in the first place. Later, some inmates actually helped him file a claim, but he didn't get in the window because he didn't know that the window existed in the first place. With respect to the second claim, he actually did file his grievance in time. So the district court just completely dropped the ball by failing to focus on the appropriate time frame. But what the Court of Appeals does with the first claim is points out the obvious fact that you can't actually be held, you can't close the courtroom door to somebody on the basis of failing to exhaust an administrative remedy that they weren't even aware of in the first place.
There's a really nice quote in the opinion on exactly that point where the court says that, quote, "The prison cannot shroud the prisoner in a veil of ignorance regarding the available administrative remedies and then hide behind a failure to exhaust a defense to avoid liability." That is exactly what happened in this case. And when you step back away from it, look, we all know there's a lot of frivolous prisoner litigation. We know that it's a difficult area for courts to adjudicate. But as we mentioned in the last podcast, if you are not willing to provide at least a basic level of care and a basic grievance dispute process to people in your custody, You need to think hard about whether those people should be in your custody at all. This is a quadriplegic who was systematically mistreated while in the care and custody of government officials. And then when he attempted to complain about that mistreatment, they asserted a complex and, in his case, completely mysterious administrative process that he had no knowledge of, and asserted that his failure to exhaust that administrative process should render him unable to receive satisfaction. And an astonishing aspect of this case, or an astonishing fact about this case, is that the district court agreed, and was only because this prisoner was lucky enough to have a properly engaged appellate panel that he will get an opportunity to go back to court and receive some remedy for the really appalling mistreatment that he experienced while in jail. Query what happens to other prisoners who aren't as fortunate.
Evan, let's move on to the last case.
Sure. This is yet another tragic case. It involves the execution of a warrant on a gold exchange that went very badly because the police officers did not either announce that they were police officers or try to resolve the situation without actually kicking down the door and appearing with guns drawn. This is a store that actually had a good relationship with the police for a while. They had gone in. They had checked to make sure that they were that the store was complying with all applicable regulations. They were on good terms, and yet they went in with masks and guns in this context.
Yeah, I mean, so basically what happened here, this is a gold exchange in Abilene, Texas. The owners of the exchange have been cooperative with the police up until a point, but they also have what is characterized as an anti-police attitude. I think it's really more of a limited government attitude. But when the police develop some information or some concerns about possible criminal activity on the premises, they have to decide how to respond. Now, one way to respond is to simply to go over and pay a visit, which they've done many, many times in the past with no problem whatsoever, or they can decide to go the tactical route where they get fully tricked out in vests and masks and guns, and they go in violent and hard. And of course, what happens when you do that? Well, what happens when you do that is it's very alarming for the people inside. You don't always know who it is. In this case, there was some question whether the police announced themselves or whether the word police was prominently displayed on their uniforms. And so what happened, as happens all too often in these settings, is there was a tragic and sudden confrontation between the person on the premises, one of the owners of the gold exchange, and a police officer. They were both armed. They both went for their guns. And so effectively, what happened was that in choosing to go the tactical route, the police created the conditions for a sudden violent encounter that in this case led to one of the owners of the gold exchange being shot and killed by a police officer.
Yeah, what's particularly tragic about this case is that the officer who actually shot and killed one of the store owners initially suggested that they simply go in with a walk-in. The decision to go with a full-on raid was made by somebody else, and actually the store owners claimed that the choice to go in with a to use a raid rather than a simple walk-in was prompted by the way that the store owners had opposed a particular measure proposed by the police with respect to regulating the sale of gold.
Leading to their characterization as supposedly being anti-police. What they really were was anti-owners regulation.
Right. And so the initial decision was to resolve things in a way that probably wouldn't have given rise to violence. But that that decision was changed and you had a tragic result. I mean, the broader question that this case raises is really, once the police act in such a way as to make violence likely, do you only focus on their behavior in the context of the violent interaction when evaluating whether they behaved reasonably? You get to a point in this case where one person has a gun, another person has a gun, and somebody is going to get shot. But do you evaluate the police's behavior before they get to that point? Or do you just focus on the fact that, hey, there's a guy with a gun, it's reasonable to shoot them?
Right. And another way to put that is, should there ever be liability for creating the unnecessarily creating the conditions in which sudden violence is likely when you could have handled it differently, such as just walking into the store like you've done a dozen times beforehand? The court does a a really unfortunate thing in this case, or it seems to me really unfortunate. Namely, they determined that a reasonable jury could conclude that the Fourth Amendment right of the now deceased store owner was violated by the unnecessarily violent tactics that were used, but that it was not clearly established, not sufficiently clearly established in the case law, that this would be unconstitutional to overcome qualified immunity. And so all of the officers are going to get off scot-free. The department's going to get off scot-free. And there's a footnote in the opinion that also merits a quotation because it's quite chilling and but directly on point. The panel notes, after indicating that they're going to let everybody off scot-free, that we are, quote, troubled by the unwillingness of the city of Abilene's council to concede an oral argument even that there was anything unwise about the raid, which suggests that nothing will be done to prevent a repetition of this tragedy the next time the Abilene Police Department needs to inspect the records of a business whose owners are known to be armed. Well, that certainly seems true, and that's perhaps the most direct and tragic consequence of the unnecessarily broad application of qualified immunity that allows police officers to escape liability for conduct for which any other person or vocation would absolutely be held liable. One day it will be time for the Supreme Court to go back and decide whether that policy choice, and it was a policy choice on the part of the Supreme Court, was a wise one.
Yeah, this case also raises the question of just what a lower court can do when faced with Supreme Court precedent that seems to produce appalling results. Is it enough to simply say, look, our hands are tied, there's nothing we can do, it seems like the police acted unreasonably, but unless it's clearly established that this conduct is unlawful, the Supreme Court has said we do something else? Or do they say, in addition to that, maybe it's time to reexamine this precedent?
Okay, that concludes the show. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, challenging you to get engaged.